program does not create an attorney-client relationship between Moss and Barnett, a professional association, or any attorney appearing on this program and any caller or listener. Please remember that we can only give general information, and every case is unique. Always check with your individual attorney for any specific legal concerns. If you are in need of specific legal advice or are looking for an attorney, please do not hesitate to give Moss and Barnett a call at 612-877-5000.
This is WCCO's Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett.
Thanks so much for joining us. The weather has finally started to warm up. As always, joining me in studio is Tom Schroyer, President and CEO at Moss and Barnett. A lovely day, Tom.
It is really fabulous out there. I can't wait to get home and get going on that yard work.
Yeah, I have a lot to do as well. Joining us in studio is someone who is a member of the firm at Moss and Barnett, Tom Sharon. A pleasure to meet you, Tom. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, morning, Steve. Glad to be here.
Tell us about your background in the law.
Well, I've been in practice for over 25 years now. I'm a civil litigator, and I also advise clients on antitrust matters. I've taught antitrust at the Hamlin Law School, and I've been a past chair of the antitrust section of the Minnesota State Bar Association. It's an area that I find of great interest, and particularly these days.
Steve, I'll just add that Tom is way too modest. He's actually instructed on antitrust law at the College of St. Thomas and taught at the Hamlin Law School. We are particularly proud of Tom for his work in the community as well. He's represented the legal rights of children in the juvenile justice system for many years and was awarded the Pro Bono Service of the Year Award by the Ramsey County court system here a couple of years ago.
And Tom, it's got to be gratifying work representing children that need help.
They're my best clients. Actually, I started with this years ago when I was in the Justice Department. After I got out of law school, I did some work in the Civil Rights Division that involved children. They're in protection. They're wards of the state, and they're really pretty vulnerable people, and they're in tough situations with no fault of their own. So I'm glad to do whatever I can.
Well, Tom, thanks so much for joining us in studio. And, of course, a big part of the program, your phone calls. We should put our phone numbers out there. We're going to be talking about antitrust and how it impacts everyone. And it really does impact everyone, and these laws are to protect people and what they spend on everyday things. 651-989-9226 or 1-866-989-9226. And something we talked about a bit before the show today was maybe one of the most famous antitrust cases of all, and this goes way back to the early days of the oil industry and John D. Rockefeller and Standard Oil. A huge case. Was this maybe the first large case in this country as far as antitrust goes? I mean, is this maybe the benchmark case, gentlemen?
Well, I wouldn't say it's the first case, Steve. It's one of the early cases. The antitrust law got activated in Teddy Roosevelt's day back in the 1890s, and it wasn't until 1909 that they went after John D. Rockefeller and his Standard Oil in New Jersey. What Rockefeller had done is pretty publicly to the offense of a lot of people, he'd accumulated a vertical monopoly right from the wellhead to the filling station, driven out a lot of competitors and incurred a lot of ill will in the process. And eventually, in about 1909, I believe it was, the courts broke up that monopoly into over 30 constituent parts. We still see Exxon Mobil as the current descendant, and it's sort of interesting to see some of the descendants of Rockefeller arguing that that company should be more green. I don't know if you saw that in newspapers, but that's how much things have changed.
I think, though, Steve, you are right that is certainly a case that stands out in the public mind for what the antitrust laws were intended to do, and I think also perhaps a source of some frustration as people wonder why there doesn't appear to be price competition at the retail gas pump. And I know Tom referred to the oil or the vertical monopoly that the John Rockefeller companies had through the Standard Oil Trust. And Tom, that's just a way of saying that he controlled oil from the ground all the way through with the pipelines and the refineries and right up to the pump where people put it into their vehicles for use, correct?
Well, that's right, Tom. And back when John D. Rockefeller's day, the source of the crude oil, the extraction, was here in the United States. They were in Pennsylvania oil fields, for example, and I think the old West Texas fields were just being opened up. Now, most of the source of crude oil is abroad and in the hands of foreign countries. Everybody's heard about the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, which is OPEC, and that really is the mother of all cartels in current markets. Because they control now about 40% of the reserves of oil that have to be constructed. You don't get any refined products until you have oil to put in the process.
Well, does that get right to the heart of it then, Tom, in terms of why we don't see price competition or more of it? Because now the source of oil is from overseas rather than being controlled here in our country?
Well, there's another piece to it in the sense that these activities, what setting quotas, which is what OPEC does, would be a per se automatic violation of the antitrust laws in our country. They haven't been applied to OPEC because they are sovereign countries, and there's a sovereign immunity issue there. Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act is a law in this country which has been interpreted to, at least in some respects, to prevent people suing in our courts to enforce our antitrust laws against these members of the OPEC oil cartel.
But in the truest sense, they are acting in a way that would be considered antitrust in this country if our laws had jurisdiction, because they set production, they control prices, they work in concert to control the oil market, if you will.
Well, that's absolutely right, Steve, and it's a great frustration to a lot of people.
Sure.
In fact, there's been some laws put into Congress to try to revoke this, what you would call immunity, if you will. It's not quite that. If you are engaged in purely commercial activity as a foreign country, you can be subject to jurisdiction in this country. But the OPEC, because its natural resources, has been interpreted as not being subject to the commercial activity exception for sovereign immunity. But it's been a frustrating thing. The legislation has been introduced to try to bring those foreign countries under our antitrust laws, but they just have not gotten traction and gotten passed. I think the main reason is it's a difficult, delicate, political, diplomatic issue dealing with sensitive matters, and the courts are just reluctant to step in and decide as an adjudication of law these foreign policy matters.
Tom Sharon joining us in studio from Moss and Barnett. Tom Schroyer, the host of the program. Once again, your phone calls welcome. We're talking about antitrust on the program at 651-989-9226 or 1-866-989-9226. And one of the things I wanted to follow up on as far as antitrust law goes, is this to protect small business from big business? And is it to protect big business or individuals from big business and predatory pricing and controlling the marketplace, or does it do both?
Well, it bigness comes into play, but in a little different way. The one thing to keep in mind about the limits of antitrust law is that under current interpretations of the law, it protects competition in the marketplace, but does not protect individual competitors. And that's a distinction that controls a lot of decisions that are coming down, at least recently, from the Supreme Court. So that it doesn't necessarily mean your size isn't going to make a difference, except in one situation, and that is where a company becomes dominant. And if that's the case, if you get market power or become a monopolist or near monopolist, then a set of different rules applies, and you can't do things that exclude others. You can think of it as like the old King of the Hill game. You can do it. You can compete as much as you can to get to the top of the hill. But once you're there, you can't turn around and do exclusionary things to keep other people from getting there.
Well, and so there is no guarantee that the antitrust doesn't protect people to stay in business. It only allows them to play the game. There's no guarantees beyond that.
That's a good way to put it.
I do think, though, it would be fair to say, wouldn't it, Tom, that there is some protection for consumers afforded still by the antitrust laws? I mean, we've seen, for example, recent litigation involving Microsoft and its pricing mechanisms.
Well, yeah, Tom, the antitrust laws themselves are consumer protection laws or consumer benefit laws. They're there to enforce a very strong national policy in this country that we need competition in our free markets. The basic idea is that when there's competition between firms that supply products and services, the consumers are going to get more of what they want at a better price and a better quality. That's the idea that underlies the antitrust laws, and they're there to make sure that that happens. So that's at 30,000 feet telling you why the consumers benefit from it. To respond to Tom's question, in the Microsoft case, what happened is the government brought a suit against Microsoft. They're monopolizing and dominant in the market for operating systems for personal computers. I think everybody's probably aware of that. The government brought a suit, got injunctions against that activity, and then there were some tag-along suits by consumers who actually bought the computers that the operating systems were in. For technical reasons, they were brought under state law. A state class was formed here in Minnesota, and they brought a suit of consumers, purchasers of these PCs, and the case was tried over in our Hennepin County District Court. It was settled during the trial. And I think right now, as we speak, they're still distributing the benefits that came from that consumer lawsuit under the antitrust laws.
So a consumer can bring an action when they feel like they're being treated unfairly in the marketplace, and antitrust laws could help individuals or a group of individuals in this case.
Yeah. I think what I had to have to add to make this an antitrust case is going to cost a lot of money.
Sure.
It's going to cost legal fees and experts, and it's a tough case to bring. So if an individual consumer wants to sue, they're going to have to be a part of a class, what they call a class action. I'm sure everybody's heard of that. But a class action is just a procedural vehicle for assembling a bunch of little claims together and making a big enough claim that you can go into court with it.
We have much more coming up. Antitrust in the spotlight today. It is Minnesota Law presented by Moss and Barnett. Tom Sharon in studio. Of course, our host, Tom Schroyer. I'm Steve Thompson. It is Minnesota Law presented by Moss and Barnett. Our host, Tom Schroyer. I'm Steve Thompson. Joining us in studio is Tom Sharon. Dennis Matuzak is our studio coordinator. We're talking about antitrust and how it impacts you and impacts business at just about every level in our country. It's 651-989-9226 or 1-866-989-9226. And there is something in the business news right now. A local company, a large local company with a lot of important jobs, Northwest Airlines, is considering a merger with Delta Airlines, and there are a lot of concerns about reduced competition. There are many issues that have been brought up. Is this a good idea? Is this in the best interest of the flying public? And this is something that's happening right now, Tom.
Well, very definitely, and it's an important thing that's happening for us locally and actually nationally. But I think all our listeners will intuitively know that when two companies merge, if there was any competition between them before that, it's going to be eliminated. The question is how much competition was there. What the listeners may not be attuned to is that it's important to get that sorted out up front before the merger is completed, because you can't put the genie back in the bottle for a lot of practical reasons. And in order to do that, the antitrust law requires that transactions of a certain size be submitted for review by the Department of Justice in this case. And in Northwest and Delta's case, the boards have approved the transaction, but they have to notify the Justice Department and then wait and get approval before they actually close the deal. That's where we are right now. And everybody is interested to see what they're going to do at the Justice Department with this matter.
Now, Tom, you've mentioned that the boards have already approved this merger at the Delta and Northwest board levels, and so they would just go ahead and complete it if they could, but they now have to go through a review process. Does that include Congress and as well government agencies?
Well, there are hearings going on before Congress, and there's a Minnesota connection there, another one. Jim Oberstar is the chairman of the House Transportation Committee, and they're having hearings right now. Jim Oberstar is very much opposed to this and is concerned that there's going to be a kind of a domino effect in the airline industry if we let this one get passed. And he's suspicious that the review agency within this administration is a little too permissive on these mergers.
What is the review agency, though, that has jurisdiction?
The Department of Justice. And they're going to look at – what they're going to look at is there an elimination of competition between these two airlines, Delta and Northwest. Now, each of them has a network of routes. And the popular wisdom is that if you look at the domestic routes, the networks don't really overlap that much. There's going to be about 12 nonstop routes that overlap out of 800. And the other, if the tools that are available to the Justice Department, they don't have to just say yay or nay. They can put conditions on the deal, and if they're just a few routes, they can force the airlines to sell those routes to another company and have that substitute competitor provide the competition and allow the thing to go through. So that's probably what people are thinking about when they say it's a good idea. It's not going to be opposed at the justice level.
Now, what about international routes? Don't these carriers fly overseas as well?
Well, that's a big piece that I think personally ought to be given a little more attention. International routes are the most profitable, and some people think this merger may be a play to take advantage of that. There's a lot of regulatory anomalies at the international level, particularly transatlantic routes that don't apply. Our domestic routes are deregulated, and profits are higher than they would be in maybe a more competitive market. There's an open sky treaty that was passed to open up those markets to competition, and it happens to just about coincide with this merger proposal. So I think we need to take a closer look at what the international impact is going to be.
And we have more on that coming up in a moment. It is Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett. Tom Sharon joining us in studio, our host, Tom Schroyer. I'm Steve Thompson. A lot of Toms in studio today. Dennis Matuzak is our studio coordinator. We have the news and weather coming up in a moment.
This is WCCO's Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett.
Tom Schroyer is our host. I'm Steve Thompson. Dennis Matuzak is our studio coordinator. And Tom Sharon is joining us in studio. We're talking antitrust law. And before the break, we were talking about the potential merger between Northwest Airlines and Delta Airlines. The Justice Department will review this. Now, if the Justice Department, Tom, comes back and says, we don't like the deal, we don't like the deal at all, what recourse do the airlines have if they say, well, wait a minute, we want to pursue this, we don't agree with you?
The Justice Department is just a way station to the courts, at least theoretical. They have to wait to get justice approval, but they can go ahead without it. The problem is the Justice Department, if they choose, can then go into court and try to prove that the transaction would violate the antitrust laws. The merger clause of the Clayton Act in specific. The government has to put together a case in court in order to actually stop a merger.
So, Tom, how does that work? They would issue an opinion if they didn't like it that would be binding until it's challenged by Northwest and Delta in court?
Basically, that's it, right.
And how about if the Department of Justice approves of the merger and it goes through, do private citizens have any rights after that to enforce antitrust laws against it?
Well, again, theoretically, they do. But they're coming into a situation where the government's approved it, but as being not significantly affecting competition in any line of commerce. But theoretically, within the statute of limitations, 4 years, they can bring a lawsuit. It's interesting. This is another Minnesota connection. Maybe some of our listeners will remember the Republic Airlines back years ago that merged with Northwest. That merger was approved, but after the statute of limitations had passed, some private plaintiffs tried to challenge that the effects of that merger under the Clayton Act, and unfortunately, the statute of limitations had run. If it hadn't, though, they could have theoretically anyway brought the case.
So will lawyers be lined up all over here and in Atlanta waiting for the to bring a lawsuit short of the 4-year statute of limitations this time?
Well, as I said, the common wisdom now is that there's not enough overlap between the two networks, and the Justice Department will probably be able to sort out at least the domestic impact. It'll depend on whether there's a good case, I guess that's the
answer. But here again, if the real issue is the impact on international overseas airplane tickets, and here we see again, don't we, another example of where international globalization is affecting our ability to enforce the antitrust laws or to make them meaningful?
I think the verdict is out there. We'll have to wait to see what the Justice Department says, whether that really makes a good case or not. If it does, and this administration is too permissive on this, I think we would see could very well see litigation.
And as business becomes more global, let's face it, businesses, small, medium, and large, have to do business in other countries. It's the way of the world with overnight shipping available between here and Hong Kong or overnight shipping between here and Moscow. It really is a global marketplace. How will the law keep up with that, especially in the area of antitrust? If I decide or my family business decides to start doing business elsewhere in the world, how can the law help us or help protect us?
Well, you know, it's interesting. This is an area where I think we as Americans can be kind of proud because we've been leaders in the antitrust area. And as the world market has become globalized and free market concepts have sort of taken hold in unusual places here and broader places, the antitrust laws have gone with them. Most countries now have antitrust laws. So that's one feature of the international globalization is they've really been the spread of U.S.-style antitrust laws. Now, we're not going to have uniformity, but there is some convergence there, too. There's an organization called the International Competition Network that has 102 members in 91 countries, and that's up from 16 in 2001. So there's been a spread of U.S.-style antitrust law and enforcement around the world. And people are hoping for more and more convergence. It's going to get a little difficult when China's antitrust law goes into effect next year and they try to apply it to state-owned industries in China. That's going to be an interesting development. Chinese agencies are going to be applying the Chinese antitrust laws to state-owned Chinese entities. So it's going to be interesting. But antitrust law is being spread around the world, and we as Americans, I think, can take some satisfaction from that.
And in many cases, it goes all the way back to where we started the show today, Standard Oil, these monopolies and monopolies being broken up. One other monopoly I wanted to bring up momentarily, and we talked about it before the show, and it's worth bringing up, and that was the breakup of the Bell system. Everyone, it was a phone company. That was it. It was a utility. And some time ago, that was disbanded. I can't remember how many separate companies were created out of the old Bell system, Ma Bell. But we're seeing mergers in that industry and a lot of consolidation. AT&T is coming back as a powerhouse in that business.
Well, what happened when they had the breakup of Ma Bell, AT&T kept the international business, but then they broke up the last mile, the copper mile, to the homes among, I think it was, eight regional Bell operating companies. And they operated separately with the local exchanges, they called it. And that's the situation immediately after the breakup. Since then, some of those regional Bell operating companies have merged.
That's
basically what happened. And now some of them are going into the long-distance market as well. So the thing that's changed, the world that's is different now because of so many different mediums for communication. It's not just the telephone anymore. It's wireless, cell phones, other wireless forms of phone communication, and even digital with voice over internet technology taking hold. So the regulators that review these mergers now are looking at a different situation than they did when they broke up AT&T.
It is fascinating to see that process take place over the years and how technology changes things. It is amazing, Tom.
And it's, I think, speaks volumes about why the law has to change with the evolution of technology. And we're going to get into that next week, by the way, I'll just note, with our guest who will be discussing the convergence of many of these technologies and the impact that's having on our legal and regulatory systems. And so we're very much looking forward to that. I would also add that, Tom, we've seen a major evolution, haven't we, in the law of antitrust over the last 30 or 40 years? I'll say just on a very practical level, we used to see many, many lawyers practicing antitrust law, and now it's down to relatively few. Can you explain that when, after all, we're seeing so much increase in the size of our businesses? Why aren't antitrust laws more in play?
Well, I guess the received wisdom, I guess, is that the antitrust reached its heyday in the 1960s, and there was some decisions by the Supreme Court during that period that were really pretty questionable, and they didn't have a strong economic basis. And since then, there's been some sorting out of the antitrust laws, getting back to that principle of protecting competition and not competitors, and ensuring the integrity of the markets that will deliver consumer welfare. And that has resulted in the elimination of some stretches of the antitrust law to ill-fitting situations. So that's, I think, really what's happened over time. There's a thing called the Chicago School that's brought economic principle to bear, particularly in this area of vertical restraints on trade, vertical being not between competitors at the same level of the distribution chain, but between entities that are cooperative, if you will, within the distribution at different levels. Those vertical restraints on the free decision-making in distribution systems needed and did get a close review on economic grounds as a result of this Chicago School, and that's been a help to the antitrust law.
And we talked a little earlier about what it means to have a vertically integrated system of distribution. That is, for example, as the Standard Oil Trust did, they controlled the oil in the ground. They produced it, pumped it, refined it, shipped it, and sold it at the gas station. And we've had some recent developments, haven't we, at the U.S. Supreme Court level in terms of retail pricing laws?
Well, yes. Just this previous term, the Supreme Court came down with a decision that's been pretty controversial, actually, at least among experts. The bottom line is that the court said in that ruling that it would they made it easier for manufacturers to fix the retail price at which their goods are sold. That's called resale price maintenance or vertical price fixing.
So, Tom, for example, maybe we would note for the listening audience that automobile dealers often will list the price that the manufacturer says they should sell a car for. It's called the manufacturer suggested retail price. And yet nobody pays that price, correct? Few people pay it.
Yeah, well, some of that's just marketing, I think. And
all right.
There's been some serious question about that. But in the past, for a manufacturer, let's say an automobile manufacturer, to enter into an agreement with one of his dealers, fixing the price or the minimum price at which the car would be sold, that would have been per se or automatically illegal under the antitrust laws.
And that's changed because of this recent Supreme Court decision?
Basically, that's what the Supreme Court said, is that it's no longer going to be automatically illegal. And the basic idea there, it's still automatically illegal to fix prices horizontally between competitors, but if it's one of these vertical distribution situations, it's no longer automatically illegal. The idea is that vertical arrangements only restrict competition, intra-brand competition. They don't affect inter-brand competition. They only affect Chevrolet dealers competing with one another. They don't affect Chevrolet dealers competing with Ford dealers. And that's got good currency in other types of restraints, but when it comes to price fixing, vertical price fixing, it's a bit more controversial.
We'll continue with that topic coming up. Tom Sharon joining us in studio, our host Tom Schroyer. It is Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett, here on 830 WCCO. Welcome back. It is Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett. Tom Sharon joining us in studio, our host Tom Schroyer. We appreciate you joining us each and every Saturday at noon. And we've talked about so many different topics on the program today, and we're following up on really the retail side and the ability of manufacturers to set the prices at the retail level. And, gentlemen, there are some instances of that where businesses have been able to maintain a retail price. And you talked about the decision that said the Supreme Court said that is okay. And there are some products that people buy every day that are very closely set by the manufacturer.
Well, I remember, Steve, back in the 80s, we were all buying a logoed shirt. It had the Izod brand on it.
Sure.
And I remember that at least initially we were paying a premium to have that little alligator. And before too long, we were seeing it show up at every discount shop in town at much lower prices. And before you knew it, we were not willing as a consumer group to pay the premium to have that logo. And so, as I understand it, Tom, this new decision will affect that and will allow a company like Izod, or some would say Bose Stereo Manufacturing now, to maintain a price and keep it high, and so that there won't be this deep discounted pricing.
Yeah, it's fair to say that it will make it easier for them to do that. The agreement, forcing the retailer to enter into an agreement on a fixed minimum price, will no longer be per se illegal. There are some situations where it's not per se legal, automatically legal. There are some situations that, it can be challenged, but it's fair to say it's going to be much easier. And under the old regime, where it wasn't so easy, consumers benefited. You've given an example where Izod shirts were low-cost Izod shirts were made available to the public, and they, that's what the public wanted. So that's the competitive effect that comes when you don't have resale price maintenance.
And now, has this decision drawn some criticism, and is it the subject of some potential legislation?
Well, the issue that really is coming up is what's going to happen to these discount stores and with retail merchandise of the kind, like shirts and other things. And one of those discount stores is Kohl's Department Store. And it just so happens that the chairman of the Senate committee that oversees the antitrust laws is Herb Kohl from Wisconsin.
How about that?
Who is a descendant of the Kohl Department Store. Whether or not, as a result of that, Herb Kohl has introduced legislation at the federal level that would, in effect, reverse the Supreme Court decision and restore the automatic illegality to resale price maintenance agreements.
It would seem to me, though, if you're a manufacturer, it would be reasonable to say, if I'm going to enter into a dealership agreement with you, we have an agreement that I will sell it to you at this, and you won't sell it for anything less than that. Is that really what we're talking about, that the Supreme Court said it could be okay? It's not definitely okay to do it. It could be okay, where in the past that would be a problem.
Yeah, what's going to happen in the future, assuming that this legislation, I don't want to handicap Herb Kohl's bill. I don't know if they're getting any real traction, at least not at this point. But assuming it doesn't get enacted and we're, at least at the federal level, working under the new regime that this decision has created, people are going to be looking at to state laws for issues, what's going to happen there. And it's important for to remember that 37 attorneys general opposed this decision. In other words, they didn't want resale price maintenance to be made per se illegal. And more recently, 27 of them enjoined in a memorandum to the FTC in which they say how this law ought to be interpreted, even if it isn't per se illegal. They're saying, okay, it's not automatically illegal, but if it raises prices at the consumer level, it should be suspect, and the proponent, the manufacturer, is trying to put it in place, has now going to have the burden of showing that the benefits that are created from resale price maintenance, if there are any, outweigh the detriment that comes from higher prices that are caused by resale price maintenance.
But, Tom, aren't we all free just not to buy the more expensive brand shirt and go to the outlet mall or discount chain store and buy a different shirt that may look like that or a comparable product?
Well, here's the argument that is made. If you're a manufacturer and you want to produce services at the retail level, or you want to have certain customer training or whatever, you have to guarantee that retailer a profit so that they can perform those services for you. And you will benefit the consumer by competing on that basis rather than strictly on price.
Well, Tom, the show's gone very quickly. Tom Sharon, pleasure to meet you. Fascinating topic. Yeah. We could talk for another hour or two, but we're out of time. Tom Schroyer, our host, always great to see you, and I'm glad to see you're on the road to recovery.
Exactly. Yeah, we had a little scrape on the bicycle this week, but we are ready to rock and roll.
Well, you're looking great.
Thank you.
Yeah, it looks like it was quite a tumble, too. Ouch. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Steve.
Once again, Tom Schroyer, our host here on Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett. Don't forget, online, moss-barnett.com. We invite you to go to the website, a terrific website. Thanks again to Tom Sharon. Dennis Matuzak, our studio coordinator. I'm Steve Thompson. We'll see you next week at noon right here. It's Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett on 830 WCCO.